Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and earned an MBA from Stanford University Graduate School of Business. From 1984 through 2002, he held various executive positions at Goldman Sachs, Marriott, the Walt Disney Company, and Best Buy. Since 2005, he's been the CEO of Habitat for Humanity. The author of Creating a Habitat for Humanity, No Hands But Yours, his name, Jonathan Reckford. And I'm Jack Grasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Grasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Jonathan Reckford, the CEO of Habitat for Humanity. Jonathan, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Jack, thanks so much. It's great to be with you.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please?
Absolutely. I was blessed to grow up in, as you said, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. My dad was a classics professor, and my mom was a stay-at-home mom and civil rights activist, and some ways, wonderful compliment. My dad had a both incredible intellectual curiosity and deep faith, and my mom had a just sort of ironclad view of what was right and wrong, and that we needed more justice in our world.
What's the biggest thing you learned from Dad, and what's the biggest thing you learned from Mom?
I think for my dad, it was really that sense of integrating faith into life and balancing the contemplative with then sharing it. He was such a teacher at heart. And I would say for my mother, it was that shared intellectual curiosity, but deeply ingrained sense of that you can't sit back if you see things wrong in your community. You've got to go out and be part of that, of making it better.
God blessed you in many ways through the years, one of which was you landed a Henry Luce Foundation scholarship. By your own words, it transformed your life. Tell us about that.
You know, thanks, Jack. It was the right opportunity at the right time. I had, after college, worked for a couple of years on Wall Street at Goldman Sachs, which was an incredible learning experience, but probably not the right fit for me. And I had a strong sense I needed to kind of get recentered on my values and regain perspective. And the Luce Foundation gave me an opportunity to work for a year, and they covered the expenses and training in Asia. So I lived in Korea and had a remarkable opportunity to do marketing work for the Olympic Organizing Committee in preparation for the 1988 Olympics, but also coach the Korean rowing team and live in the training camp with the Korean coaches and athletes. And it was such an immersion year in a completely different culture. It gave me a chance to be far enough away to regain some perspective on sort of the kind of life I wanted to live. And it was a critical year in terms of my personal faith as well. And as an adult or young adult, really trying to own my faith and decide that I wanted to really live out my life as a follower of Jesus.
You had an 18-year career in the profit business sector from Goldman Sachs, Marriott, the Walt Disney Company, and Best Buy. What were the biggest things you learned in that 18-year chapter of your life?
You know, after Korea, I went to business school with the idea that is now mainstream, but was less well-known or thought of at the time, that the public and nonprofit sectors need the same kind of professional management that the business world needs. And so I thought I could learn more by going into the private sector and then hopefully porting those skills across. And I learned so much at the different companies. I learned about how do you manage at scale, how do you manage long distance. The common theme of my very disparate career was really helping businesses grow within these big companies, and learned a lot about what it takes to grow a business and the parts. And I look back, and while the different companies were quite dissimilar, I can see now how each of those steps along the way was really valuable for me.
Every company has a culture, Jonathan, and it starts from the person at the top. And one of the greatest cultures out there is the Walt Disney Company. fabulous culture that was created, and it keeps propagating, you know, generation after generation. How do they do it?
You know, one of the great lessons from working at Disney, and I was lucky enough to be there in the early 90s, which was a wonderful growth time for the company, is the intentionality of their customer service, particularly their theme park and resorts area. And I was tied to the real estate side of Disney. And one thing that I certainly learned from them and admire so much is the way, right from the beginning, when you first come in to interview, all the way through their strategies, they're trying to select, engage, train, and support a customer service model that doesn't just satisfy but delights customers. And I'm just passionate about delivering great service, and Disney taught me a great deal about that.
In today's world, the only constant is change. And when you were at Best Buy, you talk about constantly changing innovation, Dick Schultz, Brad Anderson. How have they been so successful at Best Buy?
Well, Best Buy did something that's really unusual in retail, and they reinvented themselves, and that's where I give them enormous credit. I actually was helping run a company that Best Buy bought, so came in from the side, but it gave me a chance to really observe. Brad Anderson was the CEO at that time, and to their credit, usually when a retailer struggles, they end up never recovering. And Best Buy actually completely reinvented themselves, built a they fixed the supply chain and inventory side, which was a more technical exercise. But the bigger thing they did is totally revamp their customer service approach and the way they delivered service to their customers. And I think that had more lasting value. And now, of course, the world keeps changing. And so in a world of Amazon.com and digital retailing, it is relentlessly competitive. But I think Best Buy was nimble in reshaping their model to try to compete in this very changing landscape.
We're talking to Jonathan Reckford, who every headhunter in America was going after him because of this 18-year-old fabulous career, company after company, always going up. And then God had other plans for him. When we come back, we'll find out what they were. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Krasula, and we're with Jonathan Reckford, who was a rising star in corporate America. And then in 2003, you performed career suicide, many people would say, by leaving Best Buy and joining a Presbyterian church. Why and what did you do?
Well, Jack, it, looking back, it was a wonderful thing at the time. I have to confess it was one of the tougher learning experiences for me. I made the decision to leave the corporate world. I'd long believed I eventually want to do something more directly mission-related, though I'm a huge fan that we desperately need strong, well-run companies in our country. And that sense of personal conviction led me to go on a short-term mission trip, something that had been hard to do with a young family and a busy corporate life. And I went to India on a short-term service trip, and I think that trip was another of those inflection points for me that really where God grabbed my attention. And we were serving in rural India with the Dalits, pejoratively known as the Untouchables. And in rural India, the Bangi, which are the sort of lowest of the lowest tier among the Dalits, are literally only allowed to hand clean latrines and clean up dead animals. And they're not even allowed to live in the same community. They have to live outside the walls of these rural communities. And about half the children in these families die before the age of 13 because of the horrific conditions they live in. And just seeing that just shattered me. And I think all those latent feelings of social justice that I'd grown up from my mom and my grandmother kind of came pouring out. And I came back from that thinking, okay, now's the time to make a change and do something that is more directly related to alleviating poverty or serving those most in need in our world, and turned down a couple of great business opportunities and interviewed and actually got to the finals of a couple of international nonprofits, and in both cases didn't get the job. And it was the first time in a very long time I'd actually had to look for a job. And I thought, oh, maybe I, you know, God, did I get the story wrong? And then there was a long period of waiting. And that for a slightly type A, you know, action-oriented person was very difficult for me. But it was a really important time of having to have some time to think and pray and listen. It was a great time for my family. And in that time, I was doing a huge amount of volunteer work at my church. And I'd had an avocation of coaching pastors and helping them with leadership over the years. And to my great surprise, the church asked if I would consider coming in as executive pastor, essentially the administrative pastor, to manage all the staff and the programs of the church and free up the senior pastor for more focus on his preaching and teaching and the spiritual leadership. And it was not at all what I was looking to do. As you said, it was most of my friends counseled me that this was a terrible career move. But as my wife Ashley and I prayed about it and we thought about it, it as best we could tell, it seemed as that's what I was supposed to do. And in fact, it was a wonderful experience. The church was doing incredible work in terms of its local and international mission outreach. It was growing very fast, and lives were getting changed. And so it was, I think, now I look back and I would say it was that, you know, act of obedience that was both the right preparation step for when a couple of years later, out of the blue, Habitat came calling. And I think it allowed me to be in a position where I was, you know, both spiritually and professionally ready to come into Habitat, which is an interesting hybrid between a denomination and a large multinational business.
In 2005, as you mentioned, you became the CEO of Habitat for Humanity, which was founded in 1975. Tell us about Habitat for Humanity.
I am not surprisingly a incredible fan and very excited about Habitat. Habitat is, which may surprise people, actually the largest private home builder in the United States, but we are also about 95% of our work happens in other countries around the world. We serve in about 71 countries right now, and Habitat is a Christian self-help housing mission. And the core element of Habitat is the idea that we bring people together, as we say, to build homes, communities, and hope. And do that as an expression of God's love in the world. And the basic model, though we have so many ways that we do it, is that we work with families who otherwise could not get a loan or get financing for decent housing, and they put in sweat equity and earn their down payment by helping build their home and their neighbors' homes, and then they pay back a very affordable, no-profit mortgage, and we recycle those funds back into the same community. So as the families make payments, they're helping other families have their chance to have, for the first time, a decent home in which to live. And we have been doing that since 1976 and have now partnered with over 1 million families, so about 5 million people who now have new or improved housing through their partnership with Habitat.
We're talking to Jonathan Reckford. Jonathan, on August 23rd, 2005, Katrina hits our southern coast, decimates New Orleans, etc. On the 1st of September, so 8 days later, you become the CEO of Habitat for Humanity. Talk about being thrown to the wolves. Tell us what the first month or two was like.
Well, this, you know, I was officially publicly named to the job on August 4th. And, of course, Katrina was not on my 100-day plan. And I had this sort of elaborate plan of how I was going to travel around the world and see the work and engage, and then Katrina hit, and I became a very active volunteer for a week, and then jumped in. But it was, if you can bring good out of bad, it was the worst housing disaster to hit the United States in a century, at least, if ever, maybe the biggest ever. And it came on top of the Indian Ocean tsunami that had hit about 8 months before, which had been the largest housing disaster in Asia in certainly recent history. And so we felt Habitat needed to respond in both cases at a scale that we had never done before. And I would say it gave us permission to do a lot of things differently that allowed us to stretch and learn about growth and scale much faster. But there were certainly some surreal moments. I had not actually officially started yet, and there I was on Larry King explaining how Habitat was going to rally the country with this idea we'd come up with called a home in a box and frame houses all over the United States and ship them down to Louisiana and Mississippi and then build them on site. And it was amazing how that took off. And so I have a funny story. One of my first days, I was doing a fundraising talk for our Minneapolis affiliate in Minneapolis, and was waxing a little poetic about, wouldn't it be wonderful if, you know, we could send help down the Mississippi to our brothers and sisters at the other end of the river. And sure enough, you know, within days, someone had donated a barge, someone else had donated the materials, other people had raised the funds, and we ended up shipping a barge full of homes down the Mississippi and then building them in New Orleans. So it was a remarkable time, but it was also a huge test in terms of kind of reframing and reshaping the organization. And we went from 18 tiny affiliates across the Gulf Coast who collectively, in their best year, I think, had built 49 houses. And then that group, along with some that we started, built about 2,500 houses since Katrina. So an enormous ramp up.
Sometimes we hear facts and they just glaze over. So here's a couple facts. 2 billion people in the world today live in slum housing, and more than 100 million are homeless. Make that real to us, Jonathan.
You know, what I've learned is people can just get overwhelmed by the size of it and the magnitude of the challenge, and then it's easy to just close our eyes and shut it off. And I think sometimes it's just so important to find ways, and we need to get better at it, to find ways to make it personal for people. And I, one of the ways I keep my fires burning is to personally go and build at least a couple times a year somewhere. And I usually take a group of donors every summer. And I actually took my daughter Lily this past summer with a group of donors to Cambodia. And just to put a face on what daily life can look like, we were partnering with a woman named Soy Loring and her family. And when you think about the least of these in our world, certainly she would be, in terms of material wealth, she would be in that category. So Long and her husband both contracted HIV. Her husband died. They could no longer afford the rent on the little tiny shack on a garbage dump, basically on a sewage pond. And so she was essentially homeless with her mother and two children, squatting and living under a tarp in on a spare lot in a slum in Phnom Penh. And we built with her that week a new home. And I think one of the moments that just seared into me is we were dedicating the house, very simple, total cost about $1,200, one-room brick house, but with her kids are going to be able to go to school, access to water, proper sanitation, and it just started pouring rain just as we had cut the ribbon, and she invited us into her new home. And she had told me that the night before, she basically had been up all night, standing up, trying to hold the tarp from ripping apart in a driving rainstorm to keep her family and their very few possessions dry. And I just watched her as we sat inside her house, and her eyes and her daughter's eyes were just going around the roof of the house from the inside, seeing was any of the water from this torrential downpour going to come in. And the house was completely dry, and this just smile broke out on her face, and I just thought, you know, her life is not going to be easy now, but now they can start thinking about having a future. And so many things we just take for granted: the ability to lock a door, the ability to be dry and protected from the elements, the ability to have a place to go to the bathroom, having fresh drinking water, all those things that mean her kids can now have a chance to stay healthy. That means they can get educated. That means they may be able to lift themselves up and break this cycle of poverty. And housing certainly isn't the only need, but there's no question that the absence of housing just minimizes the chances for so many families to really ever have a chance.
We're talking to Jonathan Reckford, CEO of Habitat for Humanity. Habitat has helped to build and or repair 800,000 homes and has served more than 5 million people worldwide since 76. If you want to learn more, www.habitat.org. And I'm Jack Prasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula. We're with Jonathan Reckford. 2 million-plus volunteers since 1976 have helped Habitat for Humanity. Arguably, the two most famous volunteers are President Jimmy Carter and his wife, Rosalind. Tell us about those two volunteers.
Well, I am such a fan, and one of the great privileges of my life has been to once a year spend a week with President and Mrs. Carter building somewhere in the world, and this is quite remarkable. This will be the 32nd year they have spent a week building somewhere in the world, and this year the build will be in Nepal, in the shadow of the Himalayas, and you can learn more about that on the website. People are welcome to join us. It's going to be an amazing experience, and we are doing incredible work in Nepal. But one of the myths, I think, about Habitat is that President Carter started and runs Habitat, which is not true. But what is absolutely true is that in 1984, when President and Mrs. Carter got on a bus with a bunch of volunteers from Georgia and went up to New York City to rehab a tenement building, The world found out about Habitat, and I think the example of a former president of the United States, out there with his tools, working, just caught people's attention in such a way. And what I've seen in country after country is that when the Carters come to a country and build, that gets people who would never imagine going out and actually doing physical service work in their community. To go and experiment or try it, and then that's so often led to deeper involvement or the ability to engage people of influence and affluence in the issues of affordable housing. So there have been all kinds of ripples of that. I've been with President Carter, with many heads of state, and with many of the poorest people in the world, and he's always the same person. And to me, that's a remarkable thing. And for somebody to celebrate their 90th birthday and then spend the next week building houses, I think is a great example for all of us.
In 2014, Habitat served more than 300,000 families. If you want to learn more, www.habitat.org. Talk to us, Jonathan, about how you've successfully partnered with for-profit businesses.
We have worked very successfully with the private sector, and I think it works on a couple of fronts. One is because, as you mentioned, we have a distinctive aspect of Habitat is volunteers can come out and participate. And we think that's a really good thing, not as a construction strategy. If we just wanted to build houses, we could probably find other ways to do it. But if we want to change the world, there's something so powerful about having people come out and engage with people that they would never have spent time with on a regular basis. And there's a sense of community when everyone's out there together on the build site that I think changes everyone's hearts in the process. And that's actually how I got involved. I was working for Disney, and we sponsored houses in Orlando, Florida, back in the early 90s. And it was really interesting, which will answer your question a little bit, coming out with my team, and Disney would spend a lot of money on what I would call artificial team-building experiences, but actually going out and working on siding a house with a family for a day was the best team-building experience we'd ever had, but also connected us to something really meaningful, and a number of us then decided to keep volunteering afterwards. And so we see from our corporate partners that they engage often on two ways. One is there's an increasing sense that the best talent want to work for companies that are engaged in their communities. And so we see companies wanting to associate because Habitat does have such broad goodwill, and there's a sense of the brand goodwill of associating with Habitat. The other side is that employee engagement, and we've seen companies that measure their net promoter scores or their employee engagement numbers have found that their engagement with Habitat and having their employees come out and build with Habitat actually has driven up their recruiting and retention success. And so we think the best companies do this because they really want to make their communities better. And then there's a sense of you do well by doing good. Because I think employees are sensitive to whether this is a sincere thing or not. But we found, I think, the best partnerships are ones where it can help the mission of both organizations, but in a way that doesn't compromise either organization as well. And so, but we joyfully work with the private sector and really every sector, because our view is to do something as complex as housing, we need the public sector, the private sector, and civil society or the nonprofits all working together to solve something this complex.
What Habitat for Humanity has done since 76 is unbelievable. At the same time, the need overwhelms. It dwarfs what you've been able to do. You're a drop in a bucket in the ocean. How do you not get overwhelmed?
You know, it's a great question, and I think there's two levels. The first level is to remember that when we talk about all these numbers, every one of those numbers is a specific family, and to put faces on those families and remember that every individual family that we can give, as we say, that hand up, not a handout, you know, is precious in God's eyes, and that we can celebrate every family. And I think that that's really important. The second, which is core to our strategy now, is can we scale our impact in a way that can have even farther reaching? And there are a couple examples I'll share. One is here in the U.S., what we're trying to do is continue to build Habitat houses, but in the context of neighborhood revitalization. So can we amplify our impact by creating coalitions in cities across the country to address all the needs in these sub-communities, and then Habitat can play a role on the housing side. And globally, the picture of that, we're trying to change the way the market provides affordable housing. So a big area for us has been housing finance, and we're trying to get the microfinance world to start doing home improvement loans, because in most countries in the world, only 2 to 5% of families can get a home loan. So the great majority of people have no access to a home loan, and very few people can afford to build if they can't get a loan. So we've had now in 30-some countries, we're doing housing microfinance efforts, and we think that could scale at a much higher level. I'll give an example. We trained a microfinance group in Peru, and initially we were financing them. Now they've seen that this works, and they're giving 8,000 home loans a month. And so you can start getting to bigger numbers. And another example we're excited about, we're trying to change the policy environment to create access. So we're looking, a nice example or painful example was in Bolivia, where women did not have the right to own their house or their land. And we trained a cadre of mostly women, not all women, to advocate for the right to be able to have title to their own homes. And you can think about all the things that that are changed if you can own an asset, if you can have a property right. And this group of women were not only successful over a five-year period of getting their own rights, they got the law changed. So now if a man is married and he owns land or a house and he wants to register it and get legal title, it has to be joint titled. And you think about all the economic empowerment and social empowerment. And so that has enabled 1.8 million women in Bolivia who can now be property owners. And we think there'll be all kinds of ripples. And so now we have to do the work to support them actually getting their titles. But it shows how powerful it is if we can create the right enabling environment. And then Habitat and other organizations can then help build more houses.
We're talking to Jonathan Reckford, CEO of Habitat for Humanity. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything is Possible, and we're talking to Jonathan Reckford, the author of Creating a Habitat for Humanity, No Hands But Yours. What's the basic message of that book, Jonathan?
Thanks, Jack. The basic message of the book is that housing is a critical piece of breaking the cycle of poverty and really tries to make a moral case for it. So we built the book particularly for small faith-based small groups, but really we hope accessible to anyone, that looks at the issue of housing through the lenses of justice, mercy, and humility, tied to that famous Micah quote that's been so important in my life, which is, what does the Lord require of you but to act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God? And so it tries to just bring to life what I learned in my first year of traveling the world with Habitat and seeing stories of change, but then putting that into a moral framework and a call to action to do something about it. Because what I've observed is that most of the people in power positions in our country, in our world, didn't grow up in poverty housing, which is no coincidence. And therefore, housing isn't a visceral issue the way health or education might be. And yet, what we see empirically is if you don't have decent housing, the chances of staying healthy or getting educated go way down. So it is it's so important, we would say, that housing is a prerequisite, and not self-sufficient, but is a critical prerequisite for families to be able to lift themselves out of poverty.
What have the people who have been given a new or improved home taught you, Jonathan Rickford?
You know, Jack, I have been humbled so many times. And if you ever just want to have your heart, lifted, go to a dedication where a family who's put in hundreds and hundreds of hours of sweat equity and literally helped build their house and cleaned up their credit and worked so hard while working at least a full-time job, and to have the emotion of that celebration with the family, with the people who've come together and built that house with them. And there's just a feeling of community that's hard to describe, that a little more the way our world is supposed to work, and you just get a glimpse of what community should be. And what I've just learned over and over again is, you know, these families work harder than most of us. They have the same dreams and aspirations for their children. They just need a chance. And what we've seen is these families are incredibly successful overall. Even though by material standards they've had a very tough time, when given the opportunity, it really is a chance for them to launch themselves into the middle class and be able to give their children a whole different future.
Jonathan, you've lived in two totally different worlds. You know, Goldman Sachs, Wall Street, Walt Disney Company, Best Buy Executive Suites, and now Habitat for Humanity. And I've heard it said many times that you learn much more from the poor than you ever do from the rich. Why?
You know, I think in some ways it goes to the idea that may have been true in your life, I know it wasn't mine. You learn more from your challenges and failures sometimes than from your successes, because, you know, when things go easily, you can take them for granted or not really understand. And I think so many of us that were lucky enough to be born in the right country and into the, you know, right socioeconomic status can take so much for granted. And when you see how families who have very little in material terms, how resourceful they are, how hardworking they are, and the intensity with which they have to overcome adversity to keep their families going, it is really very inspirational and I think eye-opening for many people who haven't had that lens.
Do miracles still happen today?
You know, I certainly believe they do. I wish, as C.S. Lewis said, that they were more predictable. But I have seen, I think in a way, Habitat for Humanity itself is a miracle. The, you know, idea that this pastor in South Georgia had this idea for partnership housing, you know, in the 1960s, and then a social entrepreneur named Millard Fuller kind of grabbed the idea and spread it around the world, and that people all over the world have grabbed onto that. I think it's hard to explain that without God, and I think, you know, people have to have their own lens of what God means to them, but I am such a believer in both miracles and grace, that, you know, that idea of unmerited favor, where those of us who have been, you know, blessed beyond reason do have such a responsibility to then be a blessing to others as a result of that.
We're going to have a 41-year-old man from Cincinnati, Matthew Kelly, on in a few weeks. And he talks about that when we pray to God, we're always telling him what we want him to do. We want God to tweak in our life. And he said, God's not in the tweaking business. He's in the transforming business. Tell us how you've seen God transform the world.
Well, it is... I think that's such a nice thought, and I was thinking about it because the not so secret beauty of Habitat, I think, is that the transformation happens all the way around, and so often I have volunteers coming up and thanking me for the privilege of working in, you know, hot, tough conditions, because it has had such an impact on their heart, and that's why we get so excited about engaging with our volunteers, and one of our volunteers is a screenwriter, Randall Wallace, and he said it very pithily, and I loved his quote after he had experienced Habitat. He said, Habitat for Humanity is a perpetual motion miracle. Everyone who gives receives, and everyone who receives gives. If you want to stay complacent and uninspired, stay away from Habitat. Come close to Habitat, and it will change you and make you a part of something that changes the world. And I do think, you know, our job is to, is as best and as fallible as we do it, to look for where God is at work and go join in his efforts. And I do think there's a trap in trying to get God to just bless what we want to do anyway. But I do think at its best, Habitat has been a movement, you know, of God's love in the world, and we certainly have seen miraculous things happen from that.
I quote you, it has been said that if we take on God-sized tasks, then it's clear to everyone who deserves the credit. You give all the credit to God.
It is as it should be, and I would give deference. I think that quote came from Henry Blackaby, who I love that image because it is there's an audaciousness to it, which is that if we can look at the world through God's eyes as best we can, that should spur us to create a world that looks very different than the world we live in today. And I think when Jesus talked about his kingdom on earth, it was supposed to look a lot more like heaven. And we're, you know, our job is to make his kingdom on earth a little more the way he had in mind. And for, I hope some people that'll be housing, but there's so many critical ways where we need to create community and do our little piece of it, and then pull back and celebrate what God is able to do, who, as we've heard, can do exceedingly abundantly more than all we could ask or even imagine.
You and I met a little more than a month ago, and you offered a Franciscan blessing. Can you share that blessing with us, Jonathan?
I would, and this is a great favor from the Franciscan tradition, and I hope both a blessing and challenge to your listeners, Jack. May God bless you with discomfort at easy answers, half-truths, and superficial relationships, so that you may live deep within your heart. May God bless you with anger at injustice, oppression, and exploitation of people, so that you may wish for justice, freedom, and peace. And may God bless you with enough foolishness to believe that you can make a difference in this world so that you can do what others say cannot be done. And all God's people said, Amen.
And Jonathan Redford, may God bless you, your entire team, all the volunteers around the world. The phenomenal job. Keep up the great work.
Thanks so much, Jack.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Lasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall.